Okay, let's get started. Welcome to week 8. And today we're very fortunate to have Peter Axelson here. I first met Peter, believe it or not, almost 29 years ago at a conference in Atlanta, just before I moved to California. And he was one of the first employees at the VA's Rehab R&D Center that I was hired, you know, to work at. Peter is a rehab engineer, and after his spinal cord injury in 1975, he continued his education at Stanford, where he began applying engineering and design principles to overcome daily living hurdles faced by people with disabilities, including himself. He worked with Doug on the first versions of the hand bike, which you saw a few weeks ago, and other student projects. In 1981, he founded Beneficial Designs, an engineering design firm in Santa Cruz that's dedicated to designing, developing, and testing assistive technologies. His accomplishments include developing the first chairlift-compatible monoski with a shock absorber. He also worked on establishing wheelchair testing standards nationally, and developing seating systems for wheelchair users and creating a system to assess trails that will improve access to these outdoor trails for people of all abilities. Peter is an active member of RESNA, and I see him in that capacity frequently. And RESNA is a rehab engineering society, and he's the founder and director of research at the Research and Development at Beneficial Designs, which is now in Minden, Nevada. Peter spends much of his time traveling throughout the world, including coming over to Stanford, presenting his work and providing his considerable expertise to all these efforts. He's also an avid pilot, as demonstrated by his flight here yesterday evening. He has an adapted plane, and he's an avid monoskier. And if that isn't enough, he designed his own home in Santa Cruz and also the office building adjacent to it. And so Peter is just a rare combination of a hands-on mechanical engineering designer and a successful manager. I might mention also that after the class, there's an opportunity to have dinner with him and at P.F. Chang's over at Stanford Shopping Center. So it's not required, but if you have the time and want to talk to Peter personally and perhaps get an autograph, that's an opportunity. So let's join me in welcoming Peter Axelson.
This is just for recording. I have to be careful what I say, I guess. Thank you for having me over here today, everyone. I don't know what happened with my voice. I woke up all congested and couldn't breathe. I hear a lot of things are blooming, and I'm used to a dry desert, so this rapid changing climate for me is perhaps all it is, but Maury helped me stock up with some tea and chocolate and stuff here, so I'll keep sipping on that. As Dave said, I was 19 years old when I broke my back. I was at the Air Force Academy. I was going to be an aerospace engineer, and I thought I was headed for a career in the Air Force, and that was going to be what my role was, you know, in my work. And when I was a sophomore there, I was hurt in a rock climbing accident. I fell 165 feet, so I'm very lucky to be alive. Went through a pretty amazing, you know, set of circumstances there and intensive care and stuff. But I just really felt like my life had kind of been redirected and there was a plan for it. And I was very energetic and focused and excited and ready to get a wheelchair so I could just get on with living my life. I didn't know what kind of engineering I was going to do. And that sort of evolved in my life here at Stanford. And I just was very, very thankful for the fact that I got to come to Stanford. I got into a voc rehab program that helped me pay to finish my school. at Stanford, and honored to have some of my professors here today, Drew and Bernie and Maury and colleagues Dave and everybody that's here. So thank you for coming. And what I'm going to try to do is sort of share some of what we do at Beneficial Designs, and what I do is a sort of product designer slash engineer. I went through both the product design program and the mechanical engineering design program and what was called smart product design at the time. I don't know what it's called now. And I think my personal circumstances obviously shaped the direction of what I do. So it's not that I'm coming expecting to inspire some of you to be rehab engineers necessarily, but to perhaps inspire you to latch onto what you're sort of uniquely programmed and gifted to do, because there's every one of you has specific passions and interests and desires, and I think that you need to sort of follow the things that you're interested in and that you have a passion about, because I think that's where you'll probably be most effective in doing your work and problem solving. So I think I'm pretty gifted at sort of seeing problems that exist and figuring out what sorts of solutions might be possible. And there are so many problems related to disability that, it's like you can only work on the tip of the iceberg. You really have to work on the most important ones. And so I find that I try to figure out, well, what are the things that we can uniquely do at Beneficial Designs that someone else can't do? Because if someone else can do it better, certainly I want them to do it. And if someone else can even just do it, I'd just as soon let somebody else do it. But if there's something that we can see there that's obviously going to take the resources and people and insights that we have because of my own personal needs and insights and the staff that we have, then that's what I know it's something that we're supposed to be working on. So our company's gone from as big as 18 staff people to right now we're, I think, about 5 with a bunch of part-time people working with us as well. And so I'm going to just take you on a tour of some of our projects, and if you have a question about something, just ask me and I'll back up and try to say more about it. I was at my annual checkup today at the VA hospital, and they were asking me how do I deal with my disability? How do I, cope? And I said, well, if there's something that I want to do, I just figure out if there's a way to do it. And if there isn't a way to do it, I build a way to do it. And I think I spent the first 10 years of my injury specifically trying to prove to all the people that had told me I couldn't do this and I couldn't do that and I wasn't going to be able to do that and I wasn't going to be able to do this. I think I specifically spent that first 10 years doing all of those things, getting them out of the way to show, hey, I can do this if I put my heart into it. And as a result of kind of working on all of those things, there's still a pretty big handful of things that I still like to do for my recreation and my enjoyment. Those will stick out in the presentation. So this is my hiking shoes. If you go on a trip somewhere, on a camping trip or whatever, you probably wear your hiking shoes when you get on the plane, and maybe you got your tennis shoes in your backpack or whatever too. It's a little more complicated when you're in a wheelchair. If I'm taking my hiking shoes along, it's a big deal. I've got to have the right vehicle going to the airport, and I've got to have the right vehicle at the other end of the destination to carry my hiking shoes. But it's a pretty wonderful piece of equipment. It'll drive down a flight of stairs. It has four-wheel disc brakes, and our company designed the seating that's in it that's adjustable. So when I'm going uphill, I can move my seat forward and up and then down and back for when I'm going downhill. It'll actually drive down a flight of stairs. If any of you have ever been up to South Lake Tahoe, some of you skiers, if you've ever been up on Heavenly and you just look down to the east in the desert there, that's where Minden, Nevada is. I love it there. It's great. So my student project in 116 or 14 or something, undergraduate design was working on this Sitski sled to go skiing. And basically, I had gotten a ride in this little fiberglass thing from Norway at an adaptive ski program in Colorado. And I tried it out, and it was kind of like going down the hill on a lunch tray. And I thought, well, you know, it was kind of fun, but, you know, I think I can make this work a little bit better than that. So I started designing sit skis, and it has a tunnel section underneath it. I don't know if there's a picture. No. It's kind of shaped like a water ski. It's hollow underneath and has inward-facing edges so that it won't flip so easily. And then the snow channels through there, and you can lean forward, and your front edges help you turn, and then your rear edges help you go straight. So I remember in the design review up in the design, Termin had just opened, I think, and we had all our stuff around the lobby, and people coming by going, well, who's going to want to do something like that? I think a good percentage of the faculty, I think, honestly thought I was crazy. Sure enough, I took it to Colorado, and all sorts of people wanted to try it, and I couldn't find anybody to make it, product liability being what it was. So I started a company to manufacture them. And so we made probably 50 or 60 of these, and then somebody else started making them, and we couldn't afford the insurance. So we stopped manufacturing them. But this started sit skiing for people in wheelchairs. So then I had tried putting a ski underneath, but I didn't have the balance, because I'm a pretty high injury, T10, if anybody knows. There's like T1 through 12 and cervical vertebrae. So I'm pretty much from the waist down, I'm paralyzed. So I don't have good control of my hips. So I wasn't able to balance sitting on a ski until I met some of the folks over at Maury's place at the Rehab Engineering Center at Stanford that showed me how to, they basically made me an orthotic seat that, you know, came up higher on my body. So I was sitting in this plastic shell that sort of connected the part of me that still worked down to the part of me that didn't work. And so once I had that plastic shell, then suddenly I had the ability to balance on a ski. And so I started monoskiing. And then I got bounced on my monoski and hurt my shoulder. And I said, this is silly. So I had a guy that I was working with that happened to be a motorcycle racer. And so we stayed up one weekend for 52 hours straight and put a shock absorber into the monoski. And then we had basically the first monoski in the world with a shock absorber. And when I showed up at the World Championships in 1986, actually won the downhill with it by 0.04 of a second against Germans and Austrians and all those other people that were better monoskiers. But that really helped. You know, some of those kinds of advances, everybody was building things as fast as they could. And within 2 years, because we didn't put any sort of patent on the technology, we just wanted to throw what we had done out into the public domain because we didn't want the liability. Every monoski in the world had a shock absorber by the 1988 World Championships. So when we design high-risk recreation products, we make a conscious decision to just put it in the public domain. And I'll show you some other things that fall into that category as well. This is my my seat shell there. You see the white part at the bottom. And then there's a harness that I'm wearing up on my chest. And then there's a spring rod, this fiberglass. It's basically just like a fiberglass fishing rod. In fact, it's got a fishing rod ferrule that plugs in right there. So I put this into a tube in my back. And then I use the stomach muscles that I have to pull forward, but I don't have any back muscles. So if I don't push up, I'm just kind of stuck here. So that spring rod helps pull me back up. So it's like artificial back muscles. So we use a lot of bungees and springs and things on all sorts of adaptive seating. And I'll show you a couple of others as we go through. This is a cross-country ski that I designed. And this was actually a concept that I had. And I had two different student groups work on this. One from Stanford and another one from Montana State. And each one carried it, sort of inched it along farther, and then I built this third version. And what it does, actually, is when you lean forward, the whole thing tilts forward, but it stretches bungee cords when you do that. And then when you pull through, it snaps back, so it gives you that energy back. So it's, if anybody's cross-country skied, you know how there's kind of a kick and glide? Well, there's kind of a kick and glide to it because you store this energy. It gives you a little more range of motion, and basically you can, you know, the limited experiment I did, I could go 100 feet faster with this than I could with my other sled. So this is another design. And this is the hand bike. Now, the hand bike was another project that I got to work with Doug Schwant when you were in your design program, his senior design program. And I had this idea. I wanted to ride a bicycle that balanced on two wheels. And so Doug and Candy, they figured out how to make it work. And I worked with them and tested it and crashed it, and like I had like 10 minutes to learn to ride it before the final design review. So, some things don't change, right? So this is the production version that was out there with the training wheels that you pulled up after you got going and were balancing. And I think there's still a tandem version of this bike available too. This is an adaptive canoe seat. There are a lot of adaptive sports programs for people with disabilities. One of them is Wilderness Inquiry up in Minneapolis, and they go on trips all over the world, and they either rent equipment or they haul trailers with their equipment. And they took me on this trip, and I was like, okay, what are we gonna do for a seat? And they came out with like life jackets and cutting boards, and we were stuffing all this stuff in the boat. And then my wife was sitting there holding my knees while I was trying to paddle, and it was just comical. And so we started working on adaptive canoe seating, and we got an SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Grant, from NIH to develop this into a product. And we did it just to give you an idea of some of the kinds of things we measure when we're doing it. We bring actual people with disabilities in, subjects, and we evaluate them. So we set up a canoe on rollers, and we measured how far people could angulate the boat without falling over, just using their arms to balance. And Kathy's measuring it there with a smart level. And then we would practice things like wet exits to make sure they could get out of the seat that we had created to hold them in the seat really well. And then we would tip the boat again with the new seating that we designed and see how far they could balance with the new seating. So we always try to figure out a way we can functionally measure whether or not we're making any difference for anybody or not with whatever we're creating. And so this is the final version of the seat on the right there, and it's being made by a small canoe accessory company in Minneapolis and Minnesota. That, again, this is like something we don't really want a royalty on because they're selling a high-risk product, but it's got lateral supports for a higher injury for those people that need it, and then for most people, they would just use the lower part of the seat. So this is actually on the market. It'll go into pretty much any canoe, and adaptive sports programs all over the country, or anybody with any sort of sitting balance can use this seat. In fact, a lot of canoeists just say it's more comfortable. So then when we looked more at outdoor recreation, we thought, well, how could we make the outdoors more accessible for everyone? And, you're used to these little, I call them Smurf symbols because they're blue, the international symbol of accessibility, doesn't really mean much on a trail because there haven't been any accessibility standards. So we started thinking about, well, how could we create a rating system to rate trails, you know, from easy to difficult in some sort of objective way besides just saying, well, this one's difficult because what's difficult for me might be easier for you and hard for somebody else. And so we developed this process called the Universal Trail Assessment Process. And it's basically like a surveying or an assessment method for measuring a trail or a sidewalk or a path. And we systematically just use some real simple tools, smart levels and clinometers and roller wheels. We take all this stuff down the trail, and we systematically measure grade and cross slope and surface and width and features along the trail. And typically we would take people out and train them in these little groups. And we've certified over 800 people to do this process in the United States. So there's probably state trails people, you know, in your home state somewhere that are out doing this process to measure trails. And then we process the information to create trail access information. And we've done this with, we involved a whole bunch of federal partners right from the beginning, so there would be some buy-in from them, like BLM and Fish and Wildlife and Forest Service, and a lot of private partners as well, different state park systems. And then one other thing we had to be able to measure was the firmness and stability of the surface, because that turns out it's the most significant variable for someone that has any sort of mobility impairment. If you've ever walked on a beach with really soft sand, you know, it's a little bit harder to walk on. Well, for someone in a wheelchair, it's pretty much impossible to walk on. And so we invented a device called the rotational penetrometer that has a precision spring in it that we can release, and then we measure the indentation of the indenture into the surface, and then we twist it, and if the surface is unstable, it digs in much more, and that measures the stability. So now we've got an objective way to measure surfaces for firmness and stability. And then the Access Board, which is the entity in Washington, D.C. that writes things like the ADA accessibility guidelines for buildings and parks and recreation areas, funded us to do research with people walking on trails and determining what the cutoff should be for firmness and stability. So we stick all this information into this software we created called TrailWare, which is a FileMaker-based product that we're actually selling. And you put in all the information about your park and your trail and your segment, and then here's what your actual data looks like. So at every station, you know, 30 to 100 feet, we're putting in the tread width and the cross slope and the surface type and firmness and maximum grades and cross slopes. And then we put in all sorts of features. Most parks want every picnic table, every retaining wall, bridges. They want all those things recorded so they can inventory and depreciate and schedule maintenance and schedule depreciation and replacement costs on things. So they use it as a tool for managing all their parks. And then we've done the same thing. We've created a sidewalk assessment park, which even has a larger market because cities are trying to figure out, well, how do we keep track of all our curb cuts and our driveway crossings and all these other access features that we don't know whether or not they're in compliance or out of spec. And then we can recreate reports where we can print all the features, or we can print grade reports. And so we can go into a table like this, and I can see exactly what percent of the trail here, that 4% of my trail is greater than 8% grade. That's a standard ramp, 12-in-1 ramp. So I can see there's 4% that's out of spec with, you know, what my ideal is. And knowing that you can go up to 12% for certain distances, there's only 2%. So this trail could easily be improved in spots to make it fully accessible. And then we can look at where each of those maximum grades are, you know, how long they are, where it is, 19% for 8 feet. And then we crunch all the information with TrailWare, and then we create this trail access information report. It's kind of like a food facts label for a trail to give you, you know, the typical grade, the maximum grades, typical cross slopes, etc. So this information is then provided in some different formats. This is what we call a trail access information strip. And we've put about 100 of these out in northern Nevada. There's some on the Tahoe Rim Trail and the Tahoe Meadows Interpretive Trail. And that's the basic signage that we put there to give people access information. And this is the handout version of it. And then in parks, we've started putting in these types of signs. This is kind of a park overview sign. So this is in Carson City at the Riverview Park, and there's 6 trail segments on there, and all the information about those segments is down there so that you can determine, well, I know I can go on the North Loop and the South Loop, but the full loop's going to be tough because I can see the surface is soft. It goes down by the river. And so you make decisions about where you go and don't go based on the information. Now we've put it all on a website, trailexplorer.org. So we have a way to search for trails based on where they're going. I want to go to trails with waterfalls or trails with certain grades. And you find your trail and then drill down and get the detailed information about the trail and how to find it. And so then some of the other things that we've done for Access is that we actually got involved on the Access Board committee and helped write standards for designing new trails to be accessible. And so that's the Access Board in Washington, D.C. And I mentioned that we got some funding. And so we came up with actual standards and guidelines for building accessibility in trails that we found that, you know, people can push steeper grades, but only for limited distances, like a couple hundred feet, or they can push, you know, 10%, but only really for 30 feet. And all these are obviously, you know, some people can't do these things and some people can, but the idea is that at some point, if somebody doesn't have community mobility in a wheelchair, like a manual wheelchair like myself, then that person needs to be provided with powered mobility. So at some point, you know, you use a different technology to basically access the outdoors. And then there's different standards for access routes. And we also created federal highways spends lots and lots of money on sidewalks and public access routes. And so we created a guidebook for federal highways, and I'll just pass it around so you can kind of flip through it, that basically gives people the specific do's and don'ts of, don't pass those out yet, of building sidewalks. And a lot of our gas tax money goes toward building those facilities, so might as well build them right the first time, right, instead of having to tear them out and do them again. And then part of the gas tax money that you pay for, because it's snow machines and motorcycles and other things, comes back toward building trails. And so that money goes back to each state, and then the state funds trails projects and sidewalk projects. And so that money is available. And so we've been measuring trails in northern Nevada. Now, this is the Tahoe Meadows Interpretive Trail that goes out around this whole meadow here. And this is the information on that trail. And we've systematically, every year, we've been measuring probably, you know, 10 to 30 trails and getting signage and trail access information about those trails. We measure them. And now we're measuring them. Some of you are probably already thinking of this because of the way technology is. We're using a data collection cart where we have sensors on it for measuring grade and cross slope. And so as you just roll this cart down the trail and you measure the grade and the cross slope and the distance, and you can enter all the other features. And so that's what it looks like. And we're planning to launch this as a product, hopefully next month at the Professional Trail Builders Conference in Reno, taking place the second week of March. So we're actually creating a wheeled instrumentation sensor package, which is the box on there with the sensors in it. And then you can put this on the cart, or you can put it on a roller wheel. This is the roller wheel version. You can wear a computer on your arm. You can put it on an ATV so that it just measures. Like for ATV trails, you might as well measure them with what the ATV is actually experiencing. So we just put the instrumentation on an ATV or an OHV and put a magnet on there, and we've calibrated this thing and written software called High Efficiency Trail Assessment Process. And as you're going down the trail, it has, every time you record a station, it gets an image of the trail, it gets the GPS location on the trail, it gets all the detailed surface information on the trail and records that, and then you can record all your features. It's got all sorts of alarms, so if you're trying to see if a trail meets certain standards, it'll notify you when you've exceeded certain grades or cross slopes. There were also, another issue is that on some trails, they're supposed to be like hikers only and mountain bikes only, and they're not supposed to be motorcycles and ATVs on there. So the agencies try to put up these gates to keep certain things out and let certain things in. Well, they've had kind of a hard time doing that. So we've been working on a project to develop a trail gate barrier that's accessible for anyone using a mobility device, but prevents motorcycles and ATVs and things like that from getting down it. So what we do is we collected lots of data on all these different devices, and this isn't how it's going to look, but this is basically the concept, is it's something that's wider in the bottom and narrower at the top. So unless you flip your motorcycle upside down and drag it through, you probably won't get it through. So Let's see. We've also been doing research on, because the surfacing I mentioned was so important, a lot of trails, you can't drag, you know, base rock 3 miles in to the meadow or whatever, or it's a, the ecology of the environment is such that you don't want to put non-native material in there that's going to leach into the water system there. So we've been experimenting with using different ways of stabilizing the surface, putting all these materials into the surface. So here are some different surfaces. This is how we do it. We sort of dig it out, just the top couple inches, and this is called Gravel Pave 2. And this is actually the one that's been working the best. It's these circular plastic pieces, and I mean, hopefully people are going to come up with much better solutions, but this is the best one out there now. And you put that in there, and then you just put the trail material right back in there, and you can't even tell it's there. Or perhaps you start to see maybe the edges of some of these circles show through. But it totally stabilizes the trail tread surface so you can roll on it and pivot on it and not sink anymore. So we objectively measure it with our tools and analyze it with our information. Let's see. Here's what one of our finished signs looks like out on the trail. Those are our trail access information strips out on the trail. And if there are any questions that come up that you want to just get in touch with me, there, our email address there is beneficialdesigns with an S at the end, .com. And it's just Peter at beneficialdesigns.com to reach me. And if you're ever up in Nevada and you want to come and visit, we actually have our facility right there about 30 minutes from Heavenly Ski Area. We have a guest house that's just been finished last year, so if it's available, you're welcome to stay in the guest house. We have students that come and work for us during the summer, and they usually stay in the guest house is usually booked in the summer for student interns working at Beneficial Design. So if you're interested in applying for an internship, you can also send us an email about that. Okay. Any questions on that? Can you pull that up? Are there any questions about any of that? Yeah.
Have you looked at, so you're getting GPS data on the trails?
The position, yeah.
Integrating that with some of the GPS map programs that are out there so people can actually map their way through the trail?
Like, could they pull up a map and follow?
If they had a GPS map with them.
Uh-huh. We haven't tried to integrate a map showing up while you're working the software for the program, but it seems like you could have another view on the screen that could do that at the same time.
I guess what I meant is taking that information and providing it to the...
Oh, yeah. You can download all the it's a SQL database, so you can just pull it out in any format that you want, because that, all the agencies need the data in that way. So we have created a way to create the summary report out of that, but like the Forest Service just wants all the data into their TRACS database, which is their trail, I forget what TRACS means, it's their electronic database system for trails, and they want the GPS information in there.
What's next, Peter? We got some of these projects.
Through a few more projects.
Projects.
Okay. I kind of jump around between a couple presentations because I've got some other projects that I think I might have missed in that presentation in this one. I already covered that trail gate barrier. And I talked about the cart and the seat. Maybe we have covered all these. There's the canoes. This is a product called the Hip Grip. This is for, what it is, it's a rigid system of pads that straps around the person's pelvis, over upper pelvis, and it holds onto their pelvis. And it's got fiberglass spring rods with pivots at the bottom on the side. So if somebody has spasticity and they go into extensor spasms in their chair, it'll allow them to do that, and then it'll gently bring them back into the correct sitting posture. Or if somebody's a wheelchair tennis player and they want to lean forward and take a shot, it'll help bring them back up, just like the rod I have on my monoski. And this is a product that we actually did patent, and Body Point Designs is paying us a royalty on it, and we've been collecting that royalty for 6 years. We're hoping that the patent will be paid for in a few more years, because we keep track of our patent costs, and the royalty we're keeping track of the royalty that's come in against the patent, and then when it's done, Jamie Noonan and Alan, and they'll get part of the royalty for this when it finally offsets the patent. This is a flex room. This is a project that's real close to my heart. I have these wheels on my wheelchair. What we did is we thought, well, you know, people don't, when they go running, you don't go running in your street shoes. You put on tennis shoes with gel in them and air and stuff to absorb the shock. And I'm pushing this wheelchair, you know, for 30 years, bam, bam, you know, every time my hands hit those hand rims. So we thought, need something that'll absorb the impact, because when you examine somebody pushing a chair, there's an impact spike that occurs at the beginning of the push. So we thought we wanted a hand rim that would be compliant, that the hand rim would actually move. And so what we came up with was this thing called the flex rim, and Mark Richter worked on this project. He showed up as Beneficial Designs as an intern when he was at Santa Clara in his undergrad. And then he worked on the phase one. We helped him write a proposal. And then the phase one funded his master's program here at Stanford. And then the phase two proposal actually funded his PhD work here at Stanford. So he's got all sorts of articles written about this. And we built a big wheelchair biomechanics lab. And we've spun him off on his own now. And so he's getting his own SBIRs. And he has a wheelchair biomechanics lab in Nashville, which we have access to because technically we own the equipment that NIH paid for. But what we did in our final design is that he and Jamie Noon and I came up with this idea of putting the hand rim into the mold and the wheel rim into the mold and then injecting the urethane between them. So the only thing connecting the hand rim to the wheel was a thin layer of urethane rubber. And so when you go to push on the hand rim, usually you have to grab the hand rim pretty hard. And all I do is just push with, I don't have to flex my hand at all. Because all I do is just, my hand just pushes against it and it grips because there's rubber there and it squishes into it. So I've been using them for about 5 years. And when I switch back to regular wheels, I realize how hard I have to grab just to, because these rims are slippery. They're anodized and if they're not anodized, your hands turn black from the aluminum. And then you roll your fingers underneath for braking because there's no metal tabs connecting them to the wheel. And then there's an added bonus that you can squeeze through a really narrow door because the hand rims just squish in when you go through a really narrow door. So this has probably been in development for almost 10 years. And it's just come out on the market this summer. And the company called Spinergy, which makes high-end bicycle wheels and wheelchair wheels, is making it. They have the spokes that are carbon fiber, and you can tie them in a knot. And so it's their wheel that they're making, their high-end wheel, with this built into it that's being sold. This is another cool project that would work really well for tetraplegics without any hand grip. And what's happening here is, this is looks like a hand rim, and what it is the steel hand rim, the metal hand rim, is actually spinning around inside that coating, that rubber coating, because there's little rails of plastic Teflon in between that rubber coating and the inner hand rim. So when you squeeze on it, your outer hand rim grips the inner hand rim, and so you just push on it, and it grips the inner hand rim. But if you're going down a hill, you can just be holding onto these things and the wheels spin around inside. And then when you want to brake, you just kind of push on it and it causes friction between the outer hand rim and the inner one. So, and not your hand, right? Because for quads, typically they end up having to coat the hand rims with rubber and then it burns your hands. Or you have to wear gloves all the time. So the idea is that this is kind of like power braking and power power propulsion, power grip is be kind of the way to describe it. And we got phase one funding for this and tried twice for phase two funding, so I think something wasn't supposed to happen about that project, but it's still waiting to happen. This is a gel butt, and literally. So what we were doing is, why are we doing this? Well, we're trying to test wheelchair cushions and see why one works better than the other. So Alan Seekman got this idea. He said, well, why don't we just get a skeleton and cast it into some gel that simulates tissue that's like human tissue, and we'll use that to test wheelchair cushions. So we sent them back to Action Gel and the other side of the country, and they taught us how to mold, how to cook this gel and pour it in the mold and make parts and everything. And so we made a bunch of these gel butts, and we sent them to all the wheelchair test labs all over the world. And they're in the process of creating standards for how to measure wheelchair cushions. And they put mats underneath there that measure the pressures. You know, red is bad, green is good, you know. Measure sitting pressures on the bones that you're sitting on. Because I'm literally, at 32 years with a spinal cord injury, I'm literally skin and bones. So I don't sit on anything but some type of cushion. So I have to be really careful. I can't feel. I don't know if I'm sitting on a screw or something. I have to be very meticulous about where I'm sitting. My cushion is literally worth more to me than my wheelchair. You know, it's like I get on the airplane, I hold on to my cushion. You can take my wheelchair, but don't touch my cushion. So I'm sitting on it on the plane. So cushions are really important, and that's how we've been looking at them. I already told you about the universal trail assessment process, so we'll zip through those. This is another issue. If any of you ever seen somebody being boarded on and off an aircraft that can't walk, isn't it humiliating? To me, it feels humiliating. They stick you on this like little baggage dolly cart kind of thing, you know, and they wheel you down the aisle. So I thought, why don't I just make my own wheelchair into an aisle chair? So in my chair now I have, you see there's these extra little wheels under there, and those are for traveling. So when I get in the galley of the plane, I just spin around and I push against the galley and I pull my wheel off and just head down the aisle of the plane and go down to my seat and get out. And then they take my wheelchair off and put it in the belly of the aircraft. I usually try to keep my wheels on the plane. We already talked about the hand bike that Doug Schwant worked on. I'm really interested in dynamic seating because, you know, most of you are moving all around. You're not sitting in this perfect, you know, 90, 90, 90, you know, 90 degrees at the knees, 90 degrees at the waist. You're not sitting that way all the time. You know, you move around and you lean to the left and the right, and you kind of, you know, everybody kind of moves around a little bit. So I'm very, very interested in dynamic seating. And there's these, you know, computer chairs that they used to have where you put some weight on your shin, and so I made one of these for sitting in. And what I found is it's not that when I think people really, I think the marketing on these things really kind of missed the boat, because it wasn't that you're supposed to sit there and rock in this wheelchair, in this chair at your desk, but it allows you to subtly change your body posture while you're sitting there. It allows you to slightly move. And so we worked on a wheelchair. Is it there? We worked on a wheelchair that has that same sitting posture in it. Guess that's it. Come on. Well, anyway, so picture a wheelchair sitting in this posture that had main wheels on the side and then had casters in the front and the back. And this is the cushion that I'm sitting on. This is some of you heard of this foam called like memory foam or sleep foam, or they're selling beds made with a really inexpensive version of this foam, and you know, developing the space program, which it was. And there's a rehab, you know, high quality grade of this foam that we use for wheelchair seating a lot, and that's what I'm actually sitting on. And it's actually pretty much carved just like that picture of me. That's my bony butt there. You can see my ischial tuberosity sit down in there, and then my trochanter over here. So these are the areas where, you know, if you can relieve the pressure there, that you're not going to get red skin and develop a pressure ulcer. And so I have, what I do is I use the cushion that I make. It lasts me about a year, and then I protect that cushion. I don't leave it out in the cold. When I go skiing, I put a different cushion on my chair because it gets frozen outside, and then I sit on it and tears the microstructure of the foam when I sit on it. And so I have my older cushions. I have one of those on the ATV. I have one of those in the airplane. I have one of those in all these other places that I possibly sit. I have one shaved thinner to sit in the car. So I reuse these cushions to sit everywhere I go, basically. Ah, there's the wheelchair with the balanced seating. So you can see it has a front caster and a rear caster. So this was an example of, I tried to do like four new things in one design instead of one. I should have just started with, okay, let's put this seating into the wheelchair, but I had to try everything. So this is sort of a center of gravity wheelchair. All my weight is over this wheel. And when I lean back, it goes on this caster and the wheels. And then when I lean forward, it goes on this caster and the wheels. So it actually has, it kind of tips back and forth. It has a rear position and a front position. Then it has a way front position when you're at a desk. And that was a fun chair. This is a device called a PaxBac. And this was one of the... this is the first Small Business Innovation Research Grant I got. This is a back support pad, and the wheelchair has just sling upholstery, so it's just fabric. And then this pad pushes through the fabric on my lower lumbar or my upper sacral spine and helps me sit upright. So I sit about 2.5 inches taller with this tight than if I was there. It's loose. Can you see? You know, you see how I'm kind of slouched. My spine is kind of rounded. I'm going to get pretty sore sitting that way. So when I'm inside, I pull that tight, and I'm sitting up like that. Now, if I go down a steep ramp, am I going to loosen it? Yeah. I'll just reach back and loosen it just a little so I can go down a steep ramp and lean back. And then I'll just tighten it back up when I get back inside. So this is a product that Invacare manufactured, and then they... dropped it because they weren't making enough money on it, and now a company in England is going to bring it back onto the market. BES Rehab. That's the power assist back muscles, the cross-country ski, the monoski, sit ski. All right. Any more questions yet? Well, Dave, let me bring the next slide up. Yeah. Yeah, they are really orphan products. And I think probably I could financially do better as a company if we actually manufactured the products and put them out there ourselves. But for me, I found just from that experience of doing the ski sled thing, it was so distracting to me because I'm sort of obsessively concerned about every little design detail and stuff. And it kind of drove me crazy trying to support all those little things that were out there and being concerned about them. So for me, it was better to just focus on doing the design work. So we're going to try and make those trail carts, though, and we make the rotational penetrometers, but we have somebody else make all the parts, and we just assemble it and calibrate it. So we'll see how we do with that. So, like, there aren't that many product design firms in the country, period. And if you look at, you know, product design firms for rehab, you know, there's you can count them on one hand, I think, because I know of a couple of others, and they also get SBIR or grants as well. So the grant mechanism really helps us develop those products. Without that, we wouldn't be surviving. We also do a lot of, I'm going to show you some other pictures of it, we do some other wheelchair testing and stuff. So let me show you a few other things we do. This is our office there, and that's our view looking out the window of our office. That's the eastern side of the Sierras. Yes, it does get green there in the spring. We've got lots of cows. And this is just our office, our network stuff, and we have a library. We've got fitness equipment. A lot of our work, sometimes we have to do a physiological assessment of the person's fitness level. So we'll do a PWC 170 test where we measure their, they put them into several workloads and measure their heart rate and oxygen consumption, and then we can predict their peak energy output that person has, and then we can know where they are relative to that peak. So if somebody can pedal with their legs, they use their legs. If somebody can pedal with their arms, we use their arms. And then when we're designing something, we know, or if, like we're designing a standard for a ramp, then if we measure somebody's energy level walking on that surface or that ramp, and we measure their heart rate and their oxygen consumption, we can tell what percentage of their maximum output they're having to put out to negotiate that surface. There's our shop equipment. There's a picture of Alan. So just kind of lots of parts and stuff. And pull up a different one here. Yeah. So one of the other things that we do is wheelchair testing. And I found that standards is a really important way to help out an industry, especially for an orphan industry, like you mentioned, because I think there's not a lot of resources that we can waste. Not sure if this is the one I wanted. Oh, yeah, there it is. Yeah, can I go to slide view? Let's see. I'm going to skip through the first. Whoa. Did I do something wrong? Did I click the wrong one? There we go. Because by developing standards for things like rehab equipment worldwide, you can really eliminate some of the redundancies that are occurring. You know, most products can afford. Now, view again. Double click?
Yeah, double click. Then F5.
Ah. Oh, it went back to the beginning.
I'm sorry.
So just leave it there?
So
RESNA, which is the Rehab Engineering Society of North America, we established a technical standards board to develop standards for different kinds of assistive technologies. And the idea is that you bring together all the world experts working in a field of, say, wheelchair design, and they share information, and that allows a lot of, you know, synergy between companies and things to help move technology ahead faster on products. So that's one of, I think, the best benefits for helping to use resources more wisely in our field. And particularly in our country, we have a National Wheelchair Standards Committee, and I'm chairman of the Wheelchair Standards Committee, so our office actually manages all the standards work for the United States. So here's this, you know, typical static impact and fatigue strength tests. This is a wheelchair designed for developing countries, called a kid's chair, and we tested this one for free, so I can show you pictures of it. So here we're doing a static downward test on the armrest, you know, that we'd use to get in and out of the chair, push on it. We test the footrest to make sure you can stand on it and it doesn't break. We pull up on the armrest. It's pulling up on the armrest there. There's the test dummy sitting in there. We whack it. We have pendulums that are 25 kg, 55 pounds. We whack the footrests. We whack the casters. We whack the hand rims. We whack them sideways. We whack them forward. There we're whacking again. Then we have a lead-filled soccer ball. Throw that one at you and try to catch that. 55 pounds. We whack the upholstery with that. And depending upon the user mass of the chair, it's a higher angle for the impact. And this is a machine that we designed for doing the fatigue testing. Say Colin McLaurin, one of our senior leaders in our field designed this machine. And it's driven by a motor. So the wheelchair is driving along, and there's these slats that come around. And the chair bounces all over the place, and they hit out of sync and in sync because there's different size pulleys on there. And so we run a couple hundred thousand cycles on that. And we actually broke this chair the first time, and then we reduced the weight a little bit because we were supposed to be testing a kid's chair, and we had 165 pounds in there. So that's just some different views on the drum tester there. And then there's also a drop tester. We have a machine that we built with pneumatics that lifts the wheelchair up and a magnet grabs it, and then the piston comes down, and then we drop the wheelchair, you know, from at least 2 inches height. And we do that like 7,000 times, and we're trying to break it. Now, this particular wheelchair, I was involved in helping with the design of it. We use plastic that's like recycled bottles, and we melt it down and squirt it through a mold, and we get chunks of plastic, and we cut them off and drill them, and we put all the tubes together and bolt them together. So the idea is that they can do this in a developing country. They don't have to have fancy welding or brazing or skilled labor. They can just pound these things together and assemble wheelchairs with them. So here I'll just... Hope Haven International is the group that we tested this for, and they're trying to set up wheelchair manufacturing in Guatemala. And this is typically, you know, a child with this cerebral palsy, and this is a recycled wheelchair. So they'll get wheelchairs back from that aren't needed in this country, kind of refurbish them and send them out. But then they have problems with parts and things when they break. So this is the kid's chair, and so they've got a clinic going here, and it's got all these adjustable, you know, lateral supports and trunk supports and hip supports, and they can adjust them all to get them all fit right for the kids. And then, so this is the production of them. They're actually manufactured. All the metal parts that are machined are done in a prison in South Dakota. And then all the assembly of the chairs is done by retired farmers in Iowa in a little building out in the middle of nowhere that we flew into in my little plane and checked out. So they have been delivering these chairs for about $150 each. So there's the inmates working on the chairs. And that's, you know, when you're in a prison, it's a privilege to be able to get a job, you know, like this, to be able to, you actually earn a small amount of money, and you're not, you know, it's a high privilege that is highly regarded and earned to be able to do this kind of work in the prison. So here's the plastic extrusion that we use to chop up, and then you can see the side frame there with the pieces in it. And this is the leader of that nonprofit organization that does this. Mark Richard flies all over the world doing deliveries and getting companies to donate. They get, you know, Uniroyal sends them truckloads of, you know, upholstery that's got blemishes. And so they basically build these chairs with a lot of donated materials and discounted materials. These are the jigs for drilling all the holes. Then they go through various stages of the parts. And then different people at different stations where they set up jigs they lay the frame pieces out and pound them into the parts. So this is what they're trying to transfer now to put the production actually in the developing country. But this is their first facility out in the farm fields where they're assembling some of these. And this guy's taken us through the assembly of one of these side frames. And then they put the two side frames together the same way. And they can adjust the width of the chair just by moving everything. So as the kid grows, they can, you know, move things around. Watch a wheelchair go to... Now, the seating is all made with really simple plywood and T-nuts, which is kind of how we used to do things in this country quite a while ago. Some places, I guess, we still use plywood and foam seating, right, Maury? And then they have a bunch of gals that come in and help do all the sewing and put all the pads and parts together. And then there's the chair all assembled. You can grab these others. We've also written a couple books on how to learn to use a wheelchair safely and how to select a wheelchair using the standards information. I'll pass those around. So then they make all the brackets for adjustment of the parts. Okay. How much? When's the class over? Okay. Perfect. Okay. So I think I've kind of covered a spectrum of things. We also work on some other standards. We work on adaptive ski equipment standards. Every piece of monoski that you've ever seen or bi-ski or something now has to have an evacuation harness built into it. So if the chairlift breaks down, that you can evacuate it off the lift safely while you're in it. And so we've developed static and impact strength tests on those harnesses. We've also developed a standard measurement for your loading height. These skis go up into a lock position for getting on the chairlift. And you have to know the ski lift is now required to post the height that their chairlift is running at. So I can see, okay, that chairlift's running at 20 inches. I go up to 21, so I'll be able to just slide on. Or, gee, I'm going to have to jump a little. I need them to slow the chair down or maybe stop it. So there's standards for ski lifts. There's standard for wheelchair seating. There's another standards group working on wheelchairs and transportation. Because when wheelchairs are, particularly children's wheelchairs, are put on buses and they're strapped down, they need the restraint system needs to be secure enough that if there's a crash, that the child will not be catapulted through the bus. We don't care if their wheelchair disintegrates. We want to make sure that the child is safely fastened to the floor of the vehicle. And so there are standards for that. There are new standards being developed for mattresses and beds in hospitals to provide pressure relieving. And there's another committee working on tactile warning domes, standards for those for people with visual impairments that they're putting at crosswalks and things. And also the cross signals that make the noise and that you can push to lengthen the crossing time and to activate, you know, the countdown for and the noise for somebody that has a visual impairment to get some guidance crossing the street. So our office coordinates 7 standards activities, and there's a new one that just started on individual golf carts. They're making these golf carts for single riders that the seats swivel and you can golf from the golf cart. And so there's a new committee that's just getting going in that area. So my wife is mostly a mom now, and I was going to pop this in as long as we're ready for it to crash if it needs to. My wife, Denise Axelson, and I worked together for 10 years, and then we got married. So I have a wonderful family now because we adopted a little girl. So I have a little 4-year-old girl that we're growing with us. And then my wife still does all the standards work, because she logs on to, you know, the ISO in Geneva, Switzerland, to the International Standards Organization, does all that work by email and sends documents out for balloting in the U.S. and everything. So, are there any other questions? I haven't talked about a lot of things, liability, blah, 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 kinds of things.
Well, Peter, it seems like you're in a very unique position, you know, being a wheelchair user and having needs and having a passion and having the engineering background. And so I think that's what really drives your success, being all these people all in one.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. There's no picture.